looking back at the history of vaccinations and skepticism about them. It's less than a month until the first day of school, and pediatricians all over Maine are busy making sure kids are up to date on their vaccinations. But not everyone is having their children vaccinated. Some parents are skeptical about the need for and safety of vaccinations, and public health officials are worried. A new study from Stanford University warns that even a modest 5% drop in the vaccination rate for measles could lead to a threefold increase in measles cases. There's been a surge of pertussis cases in Maine, leading to a new vaccine requirement this year. And Maine has one of the highest kindergarten vaccine opt-out rates in the nation. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll look at the history of vaccinations and the history of vaccine skepticism. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Vaccines have the power to prevent serious diseases, and they have saved countless lives. But some people are skeptical about vaccines, and that's not a new thing. Today, we're going to learn about the history of vaccines, how they came about, how they've helped to almost wipe out once devastating diseases, and why there have been debates over the pros and cons of vaccines through the past couple centuries. In the studio with me, Dr. Laura Blaisdell. She's a pediatrician and health services researcher. She is chief of pediatrics at Intermed. Joining me from WHYY in Philadelphia, Carrie Youngdahl. She is director of the History of Vaccines Project at the College of Physicians in Philadelphia. As always, we want to hear from you. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you both for being on the show today. Carrie, I'll start with you. When did vaccines first happen? When was the first vaccine, and how did it come about?
The first vaccine was developed by an English doctor, Edward Jenner, in the late 1790s. But he was really building on a practice that had existed for several hundreds of years, which was an earlier form of vaccination called inoculation or variolation, when people noticed that usually people only developed smallpox once in their lives, and afterwards they weren't subject to the illness. And so they started developing this practice of using material from a person who had a mild case of smallpox to scratch into the skin or to have someone inhale some material to create a very, very mild case of the disease. So this was called variolation or inoculation, and Edward Jenner knew about this practice. But then he also made an observation that milkmaids, who were commonly infected with a disease called cowpox, which they got from milking cows, were protected from smallpox. They usually didn't ever suffer from smallpox. So he decided to test this idea and use material from a milkmaid's sore, a cowpox sore, to try to protect someone from smallpox. And so he first did that in 1776, practicing on a young boy who was his gardener's son. He vaccinated him, although the term hadn't been developed yet. And then about a few months later, tried to infect him with smallpox using the older method, the variolation technique. And the boy didn't develop smallpox, and he was protected. So that was really the first use of a vaccine.
Which would not be a good way to do research today, an accepted way to do research today, exposing a child to smallpox.
Right. We have some ethical guidelines that would not allow for that. But, you know, certainly that second thing he did when he tried to infect the child with smallpox, that was really the practice of variolation that had been widely practiced up to that point. So it seems strange to us, but it was an accepted technique to try to protect someone at the time.
Okay, Laura, I'm going to have you pick it up from there. I understand it was really about a century from then until we took another big step in developing vaccinations with Louis Pasteur.
Yes, and perhaps Carrie might talk a little bit more about the history of that vaccine. I've studied much more the more mass production of vaccines.
Oh, sure,
in the US.
Sure. So Carrie, why don't you take over? What happened next?
Right. Well, there were many years where smallpox vaccine was spreading all over Europe and all over into the United States and into South America. And there wasn't a lot of development on other vaccines, in part because the germ theory of disease hadn't really been articulated. And Louis Pasteur was responsible in large part for bringing the idea of the fact that germs spread disease. And from those observations that he made and experiments that he did, he started working on some animal vaccines. There was a chicken cholera vaccine that he developed. He developed an anthrax vaccine. But then the first human laboratory-based vaccine was the rabies vaccine that he developed in the 1880s. So it did take a long time, but that's because there were some important scientific discoveries that had to be made in order for, you know, the next advances to happen in vaccines.
All right. So, Laura, why don't I ask you, how are vaccines made today?
A lot of each vaccine has its own mechanism for production, but I think one of the major aspects that I'd like to bounce off of Carrie's comment is that vaccines have ethical standards of research that make sure that as we're testing vaccines, we're doing so in an ethical way that is not hurting the participants. All vaccines have to go through multiple stages of trials before they can be used in the community setting that I work in.
All right. On the line with us right now, Dora Mills. She was head of the Maine CDC. Right now, she is vice president of clinical affairs at the University of New England and interim vice president of research and scholarship. She also directs UNE's Center for Excellence in Health Innovation. Hi, Dora.
Hey there. That was kind of a mouthful there.
Yes. We were talking before the show started about how many of you have multiple titles. In your years with the Maine CDC, Dora, did you see attitudes towards vaccinations change here in Maine?
Oh, absolutely. I practiced pediatrics in rural Maine in the early to mid-90s, and then was the state health officer for 15 years. And what I saw, just my own observations, was that particularly with the advent of the Internet, which really brought us fully into the information age, it also fully brought us into the misinformation age, in that it seemed like, you know, as we see today, I mean, the Internet is such a tremendous tool, and yet it's also a tremendous tool for spreading lots of rumors or so-called fake news or whatever you want to call it. And I think it's very, very difficult to sort out the wheat from the chaff, what's really something I should believe in and not. And what I observed was that increasingly, parents would be hesitant about vaccines. And I think that, coupled with the fact that they didn't have any experience themselves with the diseases, thankfully so. But, you know, when I go back even to my early years in practice, many people's grandparents had, personal experiences with polio. They knew somebody with polio. They knew people who had measles and bad cases of chickenpox. So, you know, the grandparents often were very much there making sure that the grandkids got vaccinated. Whereas nowadays, most children's grandparents even don't have any sort of memory or experience with the diseases. So I think the combination of that plus the spread of a lot of misinformation and difficult challenges with trying to figure out what should I believe on the Internet and not, have really, I think, snowballed to have an effect on, you know, parents' ability to make informed decisions.
I want to turn this to you, Carrie. Put this in historical context. Is this a new thing to have skepticism about vaccinations, or has there been skepticism even the days before the Internet?
There's been skepticism about vaccines since the pre-vaccination practice of inoculation that I was talking about. When it was first practiced in the American colonies, a Boston Puritan minister named Cotton Mather had one of his children variolated, and his house was attacked. Someone threw rocks and a kind of a homemade bomb through his window and attached a little note to it that said, "You dog, damn you, a pox to you, I'll inoculate you." So we've had resistance to these practices since they were developed, and certainly Edward Jenner and his practice met with a lot of resistance, particularly from clergymen who believed that vaccination was subverting God's will, that only God should have the power to decide who lived and who died and who was sick and who wasn't. You see these caricatures from the early 1800s that show people getting a vaccine, which was, you know, derived from cows, and they would be growing cow heads and cow behinds from their arms and legs. So there was that kind of resistance. And then there was also resistance to compulsory vaccination, which began to be practiced in the, you know, the 1840s, 1850s, when it was mandated that infants in England should get the smallpox vaccine before they were 1 year old. Or even in Boston, there was a law in Massachusetts in 1850s that was made vaccination compulsory for school children. And so parents resisted that. What they saw was an incursion into their parental rights and their rights over their own bodies and their children's bodies.
Laura, we've seen in the last couple years, really in the last 5 years or so, an increase in the opt-out rate in Maine for kindergarten vaccinations. I'm coupling that with a study that came out this spring from Stanford that said a 5% drop in measles, mumps, and rubella vaccinations could cause a threefold increase in measles cases. How are you and others trying to counter this wave of not getting vaccinated, of kids in Maine not getting vaccinated?
Well, it's interesting. I think in that information, the increase in the opt-out rate of kindergartners, one has to realize that that's an overall for all vaccines. And one needs to realize that there are vaccine, there are diseases and there are diseases. So hepatitis B is passed very differently than measles, say. And I do believe that measles is a very serious disease. It's highly transmissible, highly virulent. I'll tell patients oftentimes if a patient was in my room at 8 a.m. and I saw a patient at 4:30 p.m. in that same room, there's a high likelihood that they will be exposed to the measles virus. So I think what I'm trying to do in my practice is understand that parents are dealing with the uncertainty that Dora talked about, that increased information causes increased uncertainty, and to clarify for them that what exactly the diseases are, what exactly are the very most worrisome diseases, and help them sort through the uncertainty by staring into the abyss and help them make decisions.
Dora, I want to turn back to you. Does UNE and other medical schools as well now teach young aspiring doctors to deal with this public health issue, to help talk to their patients, perhaps in a way that they didn't a generation ago?
Oh, yes. And there's actually a whole science behind that called shared decision making, where, you know, you learn, our medical students, both at UNE and at Maine Medical Center Tufts and other medical schools, are learning, and we physicians are having to learn this as well. I'm sure Laura has, I know Laura has, and is an expert on it, actually, of how you sit down with patients and make shared decisions so that, you know, that you're providing credible and full information to patients about the different choices, because ultimately it you know, usually is patients' decisions. And so you're trying to make sure that they have a full array of information, as Laura just actually well described, and that there is a sort of shared decision-making process where, you know, the old ways that I was taught was, here, you just tell the patient what's, you know, what you know is best. And because you know best as a doctor. And that's what we understand increasingly, is that that doesn't work. It's not very effective. And in many of these cases, and the and it's, you know, we want, and people do want to make fully informed decisions.
Sure. But isn't this shared decision making in some ways part of the problem, because parents may be making the decision not to get their children vaccinated? And then if we get an opt out rate that is higher and higher and higher, doesn't that put other people at risk as well? Laura?
Yes. I mean, shared decision making theory in and of itself is supposedly about two options that a patient has before them that we're not quite certain as to what the outcome should be for that patient. And so we engage the patient in helping us make that decision. A little bit different here in the case of vaccination, where that the vast majority of pediatricians and physicians have a very significant and well-formed opinion about the safety of vaccines and their role in their children's lives. But we certainly need parents to help us make that decision for their child. So it's a unique aspect of being a pediatrician that we need to help parents understand that as physicians, we have the experience to and education to make these decisions. And to do so, one needs to be an epidemiologist, a public health expert. You need to know toxicology. You need to know immunology. Perhaps the history of vaccination would be something that would be important for physicians to know, in addition to human physiology and human neurodevelopment. So all of these things one doesn't get from the internet very quickly. These are the things that we as physicians learn over 20 years of training that we're trying to sum up into a nice nugget for the parents that they can understand.
Well, Dora Mills, thanks so much for calling in. Dora Mills with the University of New England, where she is Vice President of Clinical Affairs and Head of the Center for Excellence in Health Innovation. I want to get back to the history a little bit. Carrie Youngdahl, what are some of the success stories? Have any major diseases been completely eradicated from the face of the earth? Which are they, and which have been eliminated from the United States?
Well, we have a couple of major success stories, and one of them we don't talk very much about, but it's an animal disease called rinderpest, and that was eliminated by vaccination of animals. So there we go. Rinderpest is gone. But, of course, smallpox is the major disease that's been eradicated by vaccination, the only human disease to have been eradicated. And this was a disease that killed between 30 and 40% of the people who contracted it. And it was a terrible disease in which a person would be almost completely covered with pustulent sores. People who did survive were often left with terrible facial scarring and scarring on other parts of the bodies and blindness. So it was smallpox was a major cause of acquired blindness. So that disease is gone because of vaccination. The World Health Organization declared it eradicated in 1980 because of the success of the WHO's smallpox eradication program. So that's a major human vaccination success that saved hundreds and hundreds of millions of lives over the years. We've done a good job in the United States of really reducing a lot of morbidity and mortality due to diseases like measles. Measles is declared or is considered eliminated from the United States. It's not eradicated. That's a word we use to describe a global disappearance of a disease. We still get these little measles outbreaks, but they're mainly from imported cases. It used to be that almost every single person had measles. So, you know, we considered that an entire birth cohort of about 4 million people a year would get measles in the United States. And after the vaccine was introduced in the 1960s, it's virtually disappeared. So that's a major success. And I'm sure, Laura, you know of some others. You know, we don't often talk about the success of the HIB vaccine, the Haemophilus influenza B vaccine, yeah. But that's had a huge impact on pediatric health.
Yeah, I would say, you know, my experience with vaccines is both on kind of the academic, larger public health scale, but also having stood beside the bedside and looked at parents and said, when they asked, could have this been prevented, saying, yes, it could have been prevented. And HIB is one of the ones that comes to mind, Haemophilus influenza B, which is not influenza, but has a similar name. And HIB used to be something, if you ask pediatricians over the age of 50 or 60, what they feared most when they were in their training, this would be one of them, because children would be coming in with an infection of their throat that would be suffocating them, and the physicians would need to do an emergency tracheotomy on the child almost within moments of them coming into the hospital. And I am amazed to say that I have not seen this happen. I've seen HIB kill kids and cause serious damage to children in other ways, but I have not seen HIB epiglottitis. And as a kind of a personal anecdote, I believe that that is also an incredible success story. I think polio is also a great success story. My mother had polio, so it's a very real disease to me. And to have that not be something that my sons will have to think about suffering from is a true gift of public health and of vaccination.
We're talking about the history. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we've been on the verge of eradicating polio for many years now. You know, we're down to under 100 cases a year. It's just a very persistent disease. It's hard to wipe out. It's different from smallpox and how it spreads. And, you know, we're working on that globally. And, you know, maybe that will be a success story we'll have, you know, going forward.
We are talking about the history of vaccinations. We're going to take a quick break. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Maine Association of Nonprofits, uniting and strengthening the nonprofit sector through management training and advocacy. NonprofitMaine.org. and the Maine Federation of Farmers Markets, connecting farmers, strengthening markets, and feeding Maine. MaineFarmersMarkets.org.
Okay, the four just aired. They're working on the 4:30 now.
Jack Spear is part of the team that brings you live NPR newscasts 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Their job is to condense everything important that's happening in the entire world into just a few minutes, and they have to do it fast.
The newscast unit does a certain amount of work in a certain finite space. We have a very small space in which to tell as many stories as we can, and that happens every day.
So I'm going to do the DeVos confirmation, kind of working as we go.
That being said, if we can't verify something, where we can't get a definitive answer that this is true and that we know this is true, then we'll hold off. We'd rather be right than fast.
The cost of a 24-hour news cycle doesn't have to be accuracy. When you give to the station, you're not just helping us report the news quickly, you're also helping us report the news accurately. Support fact-based journalism. Become a sustaining member of this station for the first time today. And thank you.
Hi, it's Mark Vogelsang of Maine Public Radio. You know, every day we provide you with a kind of deep, independent journalism that you count on and trust. And you know it's listener support, your support, that plays a crucial role in keeping this NPR station strong and healthy. So please stand up and be counted this summer on our one-day Super Thursday fundraising campaign to pay for the news. Of course, you can pledge online right now and have it count toward our Super Thursday goals at mainpublic.org. Thanks.
Coming up tomorrow, one day. You can contribute right now at mainpublic.org or by calling 1-800-866-1475.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the history of vaccinations and what we can learn from it. With me in the studio, Dr. Laura Blaisdell. She's a pediatrician and a health services researcher with Intermed. And on the line from Philadelphia, Carrie Youngdahl, who is director of the History of Vaccines Public Health Initiative. We'd like you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining me now on the line is Robert Johnston. He is a professor of history and director of the history teaching program at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Robert Johnston, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. Nice to be with you.
Tell us about your research on the history of vaccines going back to the early 18th century. Are there many similarities between the controversies then and now?
I think there are quite a few similarities, although sometimes I think we can impose the present on the past, and that's also a little bit dangerous. There are some significant differences as well. So, for example, I think the first real outbreak, so to speak, of controversy about immunization happened in 1721, not too far from Maine, in Boston, where inoculation was being introduced by Cotton Mather, a very well-known Puritan minister. And Benjamin Franklin's brother was very involved in resisting this because he felt that it was a dangerous meddling into kind of the human body by somebody who didn't really know what he was doing. And that had a lot of religion involved in a way that I don't think we necessarily see in today's conflicts. And it also involved a kind of struggle over who held authority to make decisions. That, I would say, actually continues all the way through a lot of the struggles over vaccination in the 19th, especially the early 20th century, and today, who does get to make those decisions, whether I was hearing the previous conversation, it's just scientists and medical officials and experts, or whether it's actual kind of regular people.
What do you think are some of the lessons of history that can be applied today?
Well, I think there are two fundamental ones, and then one that I would kind of go off and say a little bit of my own interpretation. The first is that controversies over immunization have never gone away in American history, really dating from that early 18th century episode on through significant struggle during the Revolutionary period and on through pretty much to today. This is not something that literally can be eradicated. I think a lot of people would like to see controversies just done. But that, I think, is never going to happen. It's hard to forecast the future from the past, but I think with several centuries of continuous controversy over immunization, we should recognize it's kind of a steady feature in American history. The other part, oh, go ahead, please.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I guess the other part is that, this is where I would perhaps differ from some other scholars, but not necessarily a huge number, is that while there have been some very, I guess you could even say dangerous people who've been vaccine dissidents, folks who've been virulently anti-Semitic and anti-communist and kind of Dr. Strangelove folks in the classic sense of the people who were concerned about precious bodily fluids. But there's been another strain of resistance to vaccination that has been populist, kind of a word we use a lot these days, in kind of a small-d democratic sense, people who have indeed contributed a good, enlightened way of looking at public health, at science, at medicine, and they haven't all been, people who have been resistant to vaccines have not all been dangerous lunatics.
That's interesting. A more nuanced look at this. It's not people who are ignorant versus people who are knowledgeable.
I really think so. And here's an episode that I like to highlight in this way, but I think really gets to that complexity. Not, I think neither side necessarily has, you know, the white, shiny knight quality to it. So this episode happened in 1913. It happened in Oregon, which is a significant focus of my research. And this is at a time throughout the nation when eugenic sterilization was very common. Dozens of states passed laws that would allow state authorities to stop the reproduction process for people who were considered morons, again, using the language of the time, or felons. Often loose women were sterilized against their will. And this was considered a very progressive, enlightened approach because you were cutting off the ability of bad people to reproduce. There was ultimately very little resistance to that eugenic sterilization during the early 20th century. The Catholic Church was the main source of such opposition. But also anti-vaccinationists who really cared deeply about bodily autonomy were in the forefront of opposing eugenic sterilization. And again, in Oregon, got on the ballot a measure to overturn the state's eugenic sterilization law and won that battle. The only time there was ever a law overturned by popular vote was because of anti-vaccinationists who cared so deeply about bodily autonomy and liberty.
That's really interesting. Such interesting research you do. That's Robert Johnston with the University of Illinois at Chicago, where he's a professor of history. Thanks so much for joining us for a little bit today.
Thank you so much, Jennifer.
So interesting. I think we'll start with an email. This is from Stephen. I wish to know why I can't get a smallpox vaccination for my child. I understand they have not been a standard vaccination for children since the early 70s. But every time I ask my doctor or my child's doctor, I get a runaround answer. Can they get it for my child? I'm willing to pay the cost. In the world today, don't you think it would be prudent to start vaccinating against this possible infection?
So I think as Carrie was saying, smallpox is not something that we see currently in the United States, and it's not something we currently see in the world. It would have to be an act, and we haven't seen it for some time. So the necessity of vaccinating against smallpox is not there. We know as physicians that everything has a risk, and so vaccination of children for something that is not currently seen in the globe in the world today does not make good sense for clinical care. I do believe that that some medical personnel can get the smallpox vaccine, but that is not because we don't see it in the world today. Not a vaccine that we need to do for children.
Carrie, let me ask you about this. As a disease is eradicated, is there a point in which the vaccination doesn't even need to exist anymore?
Well, that's a It's a great question, and it's something that the kind of global health community has been dealing with for the past 20 years when we think about smallpox. You know, as long as there is there are samples of smallpox virus that still exist in the world, and they are held in secure locations. But with the emerging ability to basically construct viruses because we know their DNA sequence, there's a thought that we want to keep these vaccines around and we want to keep the original viral samples around just in case something bad happens and the virus or the code gets into the hand of bad actors. But we also know that the United States has a strategic vaccine stockpile where emergency supplies of all of these vaccines are kept. And I think there's a dose for every person in the United States, a smallpox vaccine in this strategic vaccine supply. So I do think it's prudent for us to keep these things around just in case we need them. But sure, as we eliminate more diseases, those vaccines will get dropped from the immunization schedule.
So perhaps in the near future, polio will be dropped from the vaccination schedule.
That's right. And in fact, globally, one of the three types of polio that's in the oral poliovirus vaccine has been dropped because we consider that particular type of poliovirus eradicated in the world. You know, there's still other types that are circulating, so we need to, you know, keep on top of it. But things do change as the health situation changes.
And I think that's a really important point that I wanted to say when Robert was speaking is understanding, having lay individuals understand how science and how research and scientific knowledge works. It grows on itself. So something that we were saying 20 years ago could have been the best knowledge that we have at that moment. But we continue to do research. We continue to evaluate the effectiveness of vaccines. We continue to evaluate the safety profile of vaccines and their necessity. Just this past year, the ACIP, which is the governing body for vaccine decision-making, ruled that we don't need three HPV vaccines. If you give the vaccine under the age of 15, you only need two. And so I think it's important for the public to know that we as a medical community are not necessarily changing our stance. We're continuing to augment our stance based on the best knowledge and the risks and the benefits of vaccines.
We'll go to Adam, who's calling from Cumberland. Hi, Adam. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I'm not worried about the safety of vaccines. When my children, who are grown up now, were young, we didn't get them vaccinated against certain things, and I don't remember what they were, chickenpox maybe, measles. But I do worry that the process of getting sick from, and I don't mean polio, from diseases you can recover, I worry that we're missing some sort of that it's building up our immune system and we're getting immunities to other things that we may not even realize. And that just like the whole world who washes their hands obsessively with these, you know, alcohol wipe things are perhaps not really helping themselves by denying themselves the opportunity to build up resistance.
So good question. Send it to Laura. Go ahead.
Okay. I think you're absolutely right. I think that in the hygiene hypothesis, of which you're alluding to in the Santa wipe era, is that, you know, that our immune systems were designed to react and protect ourselves. And you're probably right. You know, the measles virus, if we were to get it, is certainly more complex in what the immune system is responding to in terms of the proteins that the immune system is seeing. But the problem is that it comes at a really severe cost. 1 in 10 individuals who have the measles vaccine or the measles virus will have a serious devastating side effect, including death. So depending on the disease severity, we say, okay, you know, we may not have such a strong immune response. And you're right, we may not be knowing even what the body's natural immune system is giving us. But we do know that the diseases that we vaccinate against are severe and that we just wouldn't want that for your children or my children or any of our community.
Adam,
I think it's kind of underestimating the risk of the disease and overestimating a possible harm from a vaccine.
Adam, thanks for your call. We have a question from Henry on Facebook. If vaccines are effective, why are unvaccinated children a danger to vaccinated children? Something doesn't add up.
That's a great, a great question. Depending on the community's immunity, otherwise known as herd immunity, the level of vaccinated children can help protect the children who are unvaccinated. And so in the case of measles, as Jennifer was alluding to, we need to have a certain percentage of people vaccinated in order to protect those who cannot be vaccinated for either for medical reasons or religious reasons. There are cases like pertussis where a child can be vaccinated and their vaccine immunity or their immunity to the disease wanes over time. And this is why many of us need to get repeated vaccinations against pertussis or whooping cough because our immunity wanes. So this is why we need to continue to vaccinate and why unvaccinated children who have pertussis could be a risk to those children who have been vaccinated against pertussis.
Carrie, anything to add?
Yeah, that's also not taking into consideration the people who can't be vaccinated. So infants who are too young to get vaccines, older people who might get a vaccine but not respond to it. So we're not just talking about the people who have the vaccine. We're talking about the people who can't get the vaccine. We need to protect them, too.
All right. Well, Henry, thank you for your question. We do have to take another short break. A note about tomorrow's show. Our gardening experts are going to join us to answer your questions. Feel free to submit questions now by email at talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. And today we're talking about the history of vaccinations. We'll be right back.
Whether you listen for a few minutes a day or a few hours,
Africa is facing an invasion by something called the army worm.
Can you be more material about what you mean, Ambassador, when you
say... Authorities are looking into another incident of vandalism at a Jewish cemetery. Police...
One of the points you make is that these are people who often come from groups who have traditionally had a lot of power and privilege.
Whether you listen for hard news or just fun.
You are in your car humming what has become one of the most iconic themes on television right now.
And it's obvious you can't. I can't play piano.
I really you sound can't. Like a squeak toy on some of that.
You know, thank you. You have such a soothing voice.
Well, that's very nice if you're coming from a radio professional.
When you listen to NPR, you trust us to be a part of your day, to bring you news and information that's important to you. Help us continue to be the station you count on. Become a sustaining member of this station for the very first time. Now more than ever, we need your help.
Super Thursday coming up tomorrow, one day. You can contribute right now at mainepublic.org or by calling 1-800-866-1475.
With so much going on around the world, in our country, in politics, you count on public radio, Maine Public Radio, more than ever, more than ever. Public radio exists for you, and because of you, your support is what keeps this service the way radio should be. So please support this station on our one-day fundraising event, Super Thursday, August 10th. MainePublic.org is where you can make your pledge online, even right now if you'd like. All support from now till the end of the day on Super Thursday will count towards our goals. Thanks for keeping public radio strong here in Maine.
Super Thursday, tomorrow, one day. You can contribute right now at MainePublic.org or by calling 1-800-866-1475.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program, The History of Vaccines and What That Means Today. Joining me, Carrie Youngdahl, who is director of the History of Vaccines Project in Philadelphia, and Laura Blaisdell, who's chief of pediatrics at Intermed. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. I want to mention that the Maine Calling Facebook page has a link, Carrie, to your webpage. It's really great. So if you're interested in learning more after the program, go ahead and go there. Joining us now, Laura Amelzi. Her graduate work at the University of Southern Maine focused on American and New England studies, and some of her research looked at vaccines. Thanks for joining us, Laura. Laura, are you there? Hi, Laura.
Hello.
Oh, terrific. Hello. Great, great.
Hi.
So, Laura, you've written about the devastating effects of diphtheria on Maine and New England. Tell us when that was and how prevalent the disease was.
Well, it was basically between what my research that I did on was around 1886. There was a very bad epidemic at the Cabot Mill in Brunswick, mostly among the French-Canadian population. And if you've ever been to that area, if you can imagine about 100 tenements within that space where the bypass is now. There was a lot of cluttering. They estimated about 500 people for every half acre. And what happened was the ferry really just sort of decimated that community. And because the French Canadians really isolated themselves from the rest of the community, there really wasn't a lot done until an editor stepped in for the local newspaper and really did a campaign around helping these people. But diphtheria is really a very devastating and cruel disease. It basically suffocates the child. There's a membrane that grows in the back of the throat. And it was once called the strangling angel of children. And it was really heartbreaking because there was no vaccination. There was no cure for it. And what's ironic is we were talking about smallpox. And actually earlier that year, there was an outbreak of smallpox in Canada that was coming into the United States. And the mill workers were all asked to, and it was compulsory to have a vaccination. And there were no deaths that year from smallpox. So, you know, it leaves one to believe that if it had been a diphtheria vaccine, that this wouldn't have happened. So between April and October, about 170 children were diagnosed with diphtheria, and 20 of them died.
Wow. How did the vaccine come about, and did it stop diphtheria altogether?
The vaccine, actually, they had an antitoxin in the 1840s, which sort of helped it, but it really had to be administered pretty much when the symptoms arose. And what happened was that it didn't do that. So there were still many deaths. About half the children died from diphtheria. And then it wasn't only until 1924 when a true vaccine had come about and really helped with this. And after this epidemic in Brunswick, it really sort of waned after that because there were a lot of things that were being done to help prevent the disease, whether it was helping with the sewage or helping with cleaning up the tenements, and that really helped clear that up.
Laura Mailsey, thanks for joining us. She has a master's degree from USM where her research looked at American and New England history. Go to Becky calling from Westbrook. Hi, Becky. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you very much. I'm a school nurse in the southern Maine area, and this at one of the local high schools. And this past fall, I had 10 confirmed cases of pertussis. And what was intriguing is when I was delving into their, you know, health records to see all of them had their boosters. One of them was a senior. The majority were in the sophomore cohort class, but the senior had his booster in August 2015, and this was this past fall that I had it. So I'm curious. I know now that the seventh grade, the booster is now required, but has there any change, or what does Laura think around, you know, what happens? All of them had their booster, yet they still came down with pertussis and their confirmed cases.
Yeah, that's first of all, thank you for your service to the public schools. Yes, it is a problem. We had a research article come out 2 years ago now demonstrating that sometimes even to the booster, kids will have waning immunity as early as a year after the booster. And this is a real dilemma. We're trying to sort it out right now in the medical community, in the research community, to determine whether or not there has been a change in the pertussis, the circulating pertussis organisms that has made it less susceptible to our vaccine. However, I also will just comment that whenever we design a vaccine, we are looking at the acceptable side effects. And we did have a pertussis vaccine that was extremely effective, caused, I believe, two inoculations would cause lifelong immunity, but it had a very high side effect of fevers. And the fevers, a certain percentage of our population will have seizures when they have high fevers. So that vaccine was subsequently pulled, and this vaccine was put in place of that because of the side effect profile is so much more acceptable. But this is a real challenge that we need to face in the next 5 to 10 years.
Becky, thanks for calling in. I'm going to go to an email from Dean. Known cancer-causing SV40 contamination of polio vaccines, not publicly disclosed for decades. First polio vaccine caused so many deaths it was stopped. And new vaccine from monkey kidney with known SV40, simian virus 40, contamination. a bit cryptic, but does that, do you understand what Dean is saying, Carrie?
Yes, I do. I know that he is referring to the fact that early polio vaccines were discovered to have contained this simian virus. It was called SV40. It wasn't concealed for decades because it was uncovered in the early 1960s by a vaccine researcher. And so it was very quickly addressed. And then we've had some large epidemiological follow-up studies trying to look at if this receipt of this vaccine led to increased cancer incidence in the recipients. And as far as I know, there have been no findings, so it is not associated with a cancer risk. But I do know that it did lead to scrutiny of vaccine components and change in the way that vaccines were developed. So this is, you know, a constant challenge to the medical community to try to assess the safety of vaccines and address problems that arise and come up with new methods. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that, Laura. It's not something that's currently a topic of concern because I think people feel like it's been addressed and there's no increase in cancer risk in people who receive those vaccines in the late 50s and early 60s.
Yeah, I believe it was related solely to the vaccines given from 1955 to the mid-1960s. And it is really important to acknowledge that when we intervene in any medical way, we need to be sure about the risks and benefits of that. There is no medicine intervention vaccination that is completely risk-free. And I think that that's what a lot of parents are looking for me to acknowledge, is that when we vaccinate a child, we are taking risks. And we hope as the medical community, we can quantify those very, very, very small risks against the likelihood that a child will get a disease and B, have a serious side effect against it. So I do acknowledge concerns about vaccine components and the way that vaccines are made, and ask that we take each opportunity to weigh it against the benefit of having a polio vaccine, and knowing that, again, how science and medical advances happen and occur is through trial and error and the addition of knowledge to our foundation of knowledge base, which hopefully is getting safer each year.
We'll go to Frank, who's calling from Orono. Hi, Frank. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Looking at my personal history with vaccines, I mean, I was a military brat, so my shot records are pages long. And as a parent today, it's different. And I like what you said about the more information can kind of lead to more uncertainty. I'd like to use the HPV vaccine as an example. I mean, being at my 13-year-old son's annual physical, they give you that option. Would you like him to have this vaccine? If you go on Google and Google that vaccine, you get a lot of negative information. You get a lot of positive information. And, you know, the percentage of the population that has this virus doesn't necessarily affect males. You know, we don't have to get into the intricacies of that. But in the decision-making process for a parent, where do you think is the best place to get reliable information? And what are your thoughts on an instance like this where females versus males get a vaccine in their teenage years?
Oh, that's a great question. I tell parents often in the exam room that anybody on the internet who assures you that you should do one thing or another probably doesn't have your child's best interest in mind. So I believe talking with your healthcare professional who is invested in the health of your child and who actually gives these vaccines and sees the side effects of the vaccines and the benefits of the vaccines are probably one of your best sources of information. There are also great other sources of information. The CDC has great sources of information for people who feel that they trust the CDC, which I do. But some people also feel like they would like information that is not government related. And I usually go to the Center the Center for Vaccine Education at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. That's Dr. Offit's Vaccine Education Center, and he has wonderfully well laid out well articulated commentary on why we do each vaccine. As far as the HPV vaccine and women and girls and boys, I also have a now 14-year-old son, so was in the hot seat with my pediatrician having the conversation. And yes, while we know that HPV is one of the, is the leading cause of cervical cancer, HPV also causes penile cancer, it causes genital warts, and we're having a rise in this country of oral pharyngeal cancer, and HPV is one of the leading causes of that as well. So I think it's important to have those conversations with your pediatrician as well about what your child's risk is. HPV is one of those viruses. It's very tricky, and by the time we turn 25, the majority of us will have been exposed to it. So it's a really important conversation to be having.
Frank, thank you so much for your call. A Facebook post here from Karen. I think people need to be made aware of how devastating these diseases were. Children dying of measles, pictures of people who've had smallpox, iron lungs and braces, and the adult syndrome from poliomyelitis have been forgotten. Google the diseases along with the vaccine safety, please. And I'm going to let you have the last word, Carrie, a response to that.
Well, that's one of the reasons we started the History of Vaccines Project at the College of Physicians, was to show people what these diseases look like. So I invite you to go to historyofvaccines.org to see what it looked like to have smallpox and what it looked like to have polio. So you're right. We need to remember the devastating effects of these diseases and use the history, use history to inform our present decision making.
All right. Well, thank you so much, both of you. That was Carrie Youngdahl. She is director of the History of Vaccines Project of the College of Physicians in Philadelphia. And they have terrific resources that she mentioned on the web. She joins us from the studio of WHYY. And Dr. Laura Blaisdell is a health services researcher and pediatrician. She is chief of pediatrics at Intermed. Sandra Harris ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, our gardening experts answer your questions during Super Thursday. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.